Hi, I'm Andrew Kirkendall from Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, here with Soho Insider, where we're putting together a series of podcasts, and I'll be your MPN podcast host. And for our kickoff podcast, we have with us Gabby Hobbs. Gabby, you can go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks so much. I'm excited to be part of this podcast. I'm Gabby Hobbs, and I practice at Mass General Hospital in Boston, where I take care of patients with MPNs.
Awesome. Awesome. So we'll have a series of different topics within this podcast, but I think the overarching theme with this specific one will be talking about how we kind of define and target different goals of therapy in myelofibrosis. And kind of a topic that I think is interesting as we think about, well, one, how do we kind of get on the same page with and have shared decisions with our patients? How do we design clinical trials, right? How do we kind of make it so that the drugs that we're developing for this tackle important kind of clinical questions that are relevant to patients as well as relevant to the disease? And when I was thinking about this topic, I was kind of thinking about how people tackle these goals of therapy in different diseases. Because I think when we think about oncology, you know, we're often talking about cures and response rates and getting rid of the disease, but I don't think that's necessarily a ubiquitous goal across medicine. We think about blood pressure, you know, you're trying to control blood pressure to reduce the risk of cardiovascular events. For Hodgkin's disease, certainly that's something that we're aiming for cure in a broad number of patients. But for autoimmune diseases like lupus, you know, you're really targeting kind of, you know, retaining or improving kidney function because we know that's associated with better overall survival. So I think the point being is that, you know, we often think in oncology, you're either going after a cure or you're focused on like palliation. And I don't know if I think there's certainly a middle ground there. And I think there's a lot of nuance there. So I guess with that lead in, Gabby, how do you define kind of your treatment goals in patients with myelofibrosis?
Yeah, no, what a good introduction. I mean, I think myelofibrosis is such a unique malignancy in that all of the drugs that have been approved really have not had survival as an endpoint, you know, with ruxolitinib really setting the standard for our drug approvals. And so with, you know, that really, I think, frames a lot of how we talk to our patients about our treatment. You know, even though we know that with some of the JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib, there's a survival advantage, the bulk of the conversation really that you're having with patients when you're starting them on treatment is about improving their symptoms and their quality of life with these medications. And so I think that that's sort of one aspect of talking to patients about therapy. And another tool that's helpful is, you know, you use whatever risk stratification system you want to utilize. And then that kind of helps to orient the conversation about goals, where you say, listen, I'm looking at your lab values, your mutations, et cetera. And I think that we should try to get to transplant. And then you decide, you know, is that patient a transplant candidate? And so really for those patients, it's more traditional in that you're trying to get them to cure with a curative therapy. But as you know, most of the patients are not going to be transplant candidates. And so then you really have to have the discussion about there's what we would want to accomplish and what we can accomplish. And I think you need to be really honest with patients about that from the beginning so they understand that the treatments that they're getting are not curative, but that doesn't mean that they're not meaningful because they can extend their life potentially and improve the quality of life as well.
Yeah, I think it's important, right? So you were kind of thinking about this on a patient by patient basis. You know, in some patients, your goal is cure, right? And others, maybe it's defining something else that allows them to live a better life, right? Whether it's spleen or symptoms. I think, you know, we're starting to understand that maybe targeting anemia, something that I would say largely we've punted in the past, right? We often were like, no, we still can respond in terms of spleen and symptoms, despite the fact that patients may get more anemic. I think now we're starting to understand that really might be the kind of third kind of goal of treatment outside of cure in terms of spleen symptoms, and we need to at least consider the anemia, maybe improve it, even though I think that's still an area where we can get better at.
And I think that as our therapies get better, then we're able to offer more goals of therapy for our patients, right? I think when we just had ruxolitinib, like you said, we've punted the anemia before because we didn't have anything else to say. So we'd say, well, here we have this drug. And I know I'm going to make you worse in some ways, but I also, you know, you kind of balance it. So as therapies have gotten better, I think we can offer more to our patients. And one thing that I wanted to add was also that for many patients, like you said, you know, they're going to live with this disease for a long time. And so balancing also the, you know, telling patients that they may not be able to get cured of this disease, but that for the long time that they could potentially live with this disease, you're going to help them, you know, optimize their quality of life is important too.
Yeah, it's a great point. And the anemia part is fascinating to me because I think we did kind of punt it because we didn't have therapies that could help it. But I think it's also because we punted it so early, it also impaired the development of newer therapies where I mean, you look at something like, you know, Simplify One with momelotinib versus ruxolitinib, and it was designed as a non-inferiority study. And we could certainly get into the design of that study, right, and there are some flaws there, but it clearly showed benefits in terms of anemia, but that wasn't really looked at because we're like, no, that's not important. Like, right, like that, we're not focused on that. We're very focused on non-inferiority of spleen and symptoms. But in reality, like, we probably should have factored that in, right? Because it was meaningful then. And then it took what, you know, another 5-6 years to get the approval of the drug, really based on the fact that what we saw initially, it was like, oh yeah, actually that was important. Now we have to figure out how to like develop this drug to show what we already know. And I think sometimes, you know, you certainly don't want to be delaying things because you're not thinking proactively. And so with that in mind, I think we, you know, it behooves us to try to think about how to kind of define better endpoints as we move forward. You mentioned that, you know, and I think you kind of touched on this, that you know, cure is still an option for patients, right? We certainly don't want to, you don't want to forget that, because there are patients where allogeneic stem cell transplant can't offer a curative therapy. Certainly those patients, you know, need to be fit and eligible to go under transplant. They need to have higher risk disease that warrants it. But beyond that small number of patients that will go towards transplant, you know, we can't forget the fact that, you know, this is a disease they're going to live with for a long time. And I think that we've, you know, I think us in the community, right, we've talked a lot. We almost joke about it sometimes. We talk about, you know, disease modification, and we need to go after disease modification. And I completely agree with that. I think it's an aspirational goal. It's clearly something that we've had a challenge in, actually. I don't know if a challenge in accomplishing, but it's certainly a challenge in demonstrating and showing that we're doing that. I mean, you could argue that things that, you know, shrink the spleen and improve disease-related symptoms for a long period of time, that modifies the disease on a patient level. But I think we're talking about kind of getting rid of the mutations that drive the disease, normalizing what the bone marrow looks like. That hasn't really been demonstrated pretty clearly with any of the agents that we've either have approved or that are in development. But I think that, you know, we also have to kind of look at this. You know, we always talk about myelofibrosis as an inflammatory disease, right? A disease of inflammation. It's certainly a chronic leukemia. And we think about endpoints from the chronic leukemia side, but what about endpoints in inflammatory disease? I mean, I think that with endpoints in inflammatory disease, you're often talking about kind of ability to kind of reduce organ dysfunction, minimize kind of exacerbations or worsening of function. And I think, you know, I don't think we should take our eyes off that ball, right? Because in the vast majority of our patients, as you mentioned, they're going to be living with this disease for 5, 10, 15 years. And if all we care about is disease modification, getting rid of the disease, we may, you know, lose an opportunity to help patients for other things that they're at risk for during that period of time. And so I know that actually this is where some of your research comes in, and you've done a really nice job, I think, collaborating with other specialties to look at kind of various risks or comorbidities or things that impact patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms and myelofibrosis, specifically looking at cardiovascular outcomes and osteoporosis, as well as pulmonary hypertension and lifestyle things. So tell us a little bit about your work there, because I think I think sometimes we're kind of losing the forest for the trees. And I think you focused on the trees a lot of times.
Thanks. I mean, obviously the goal as an MPN doctor is to be able to offer cure to your patients and to, you know, prolong their survival. But like you said, you know, many of these patients, and not just the myelofibrosis patients, but, you know, patients with MPNs in general are going to live with these conditions for a long time. And we know from other heme malignancies as well, and that, you know, these are diseases of inflammation. And inflammation can impact, you know, every part of our body. And I think there hasn't been enough research done to look at how to manage other comorbidities that our patients live with. And so I think the first place to start is to remind patients that you're not their primary care doctor. Although, you know, if you're able to do both, then more power to you. I know I certainly cannot. And so reminding people to do, you know, have a primary care doctor, a cardiologist if appropriate, and staying up to date with their healthcare maintenance is so important, because we've demonstrated that in others that these patients are at higher risk for having other malignancies. So they can't forget about that. A question that I get often from my patients is, should I get on a statin preemptively? Should I start metformin preemptively? And do I need to be more aggressive in managing my cardiovascular comorbidities? And we really just don't know. So I think one of the interesting parts of my research has just been, you know, using a variety of different databases to show that patients with MPN, not surprisingly, have worse cardiovascular outcomes from common cardiovascular comorbidities than patients without an MPN. And so things like atrial fibrillation, the most common arrhythmia, MPN patients have high rates of atrial fibrillation. If they're in their 70s or 80, about 30% of patients will have atrial fibrillation, and their outcomes with AFib are worse. Patients with congestive heart failure, if they get admitted to the hospital and they have an MPN, they're much more likely to get readmitted and much more likely to have a major adverse cardiovascular event after that hospitalization. And along those lines, we know that patients with MPNs are at higher risk of having pulmonary hypertension, and we've known that for a while. But it's not just the myelofibrosis patients. It's patients with PV and ET that also have pulmonary hypertension. And what I find really interesting about that observation is that patients with pulmonary hypertension that don't have other cardiovascular comorbidities that just have like idiopathic pulmonary hypertension, or that like class 5 pulmonary hypertension without a clear etiology, don't just have worse outcomes because they have, you know, pulmonary hypertension, but they're higher rates, they have higher rates of progression from their chronic MPN, like ET and PV, to myelofibrosis and to leukemia and having a shorter survival. And so there's so much that we, I think, need to learn about how our MPN patients are impacted by these other medical conditions. And it kind of goes both ways. You know, should we start screening our patients earlier? And if you find that they have pulmonary hypertension, do you treat their MPN more aggressively, or do you treat their cardiovascular disease more aggressively? And I think, so there's really a lot to investigate there. But it's difficult to do without, you know, big collaborations and big databases, because, you know, many of these outcomes take a long time to develop.
I think it's the tip of the iceberg. I think when we're thinking about early intervention, you know, we're often, you know, we kind of sit in our silos and think about early intervention from the malignant side of things, but earlier intervention probably can apply to how do we protect these patients from kind of non-hematologic adverse events that come with the disease. So how do we protect them from developing that pulmonary hypertension? How do we protect them, you know, maximize their cardiovascular health and things of that nature? And so I think it's really important. I think this is the start of that. And I think, you know, it further, you mentioned you can't be the primary care doctor and the hematologist. I think it's too hard. Things are too specialized. It's too difficult. But I think we really need to strengthen those relationships that we have with the other specialties, you know, and educate them on the fact that, you know, hey, I'm going to be sending you a good amount of patients, and they're at risk for these things. And you know, maybe start these collaborations, you know, prospectively to try to figure out how to best improve outcomes. So I kind of applaud you on these efforts, because I do think that this has huge clinical relevance for patients as we try to help let them live with their disease for a longer period of time. So not to say that we're not going after disease modification, right? Like, we certainly do want to get rid of the disease, right? I'm not minimizing that, but we can, you know, we can certainly not let perfection be the enemy of good right now. So, you know, with that in mind, I do want to transition. We have, we're entering kind of meeting season, as the kids would say, meeting SZN, right? Season. EHA and ASCO coming up, clearly two big meetings, I think, certainly in the U.S. and in Chicago for ASCO, and then heading over to Milan for EHA. But anything exciting on your radar as these meetings come into play? Or I know we always certainly have expectations for different data sets coming out, and anything in your mind that you're looking at?
So, you know, I think in the heme malignancies world, we usually look at ASCO and are always, you know, wish we would see more presented there. But I have to say that this year, I'm really looking forward to a lot of presentations at ASCO, and was happy to see a lot of MPN specific presentations, including your presentation, Andrew, which is obviously going to be very exciting to hear you talk about rusfertide and the plenary for ASCO. You know, I don't know that polycythemia vera has been highlighted in a plenary session at ASCO before, so congratulations. And along those lines, you know, we also have potentially data presented on essential thrombocythemia utilizing ROPIG interferon by Dr. Mesa. And, you know, for all of us that treat MPNs, we've been using ROPIG for several years for polycythemia vera, and it's a really well-tolerated medication. So looks like potentially promising for ET as well. And so in addition to those two, you know, for myelofibrosis, there's going to be some data presented, you know, looking at imetelstat and selinexor, et cetera. But I think which is great. I think both of those, you know, they've been going through their trials, and we've heard about how they're doing at several meetings already. But one of the things that I'm looking forward to for these coming meetings and, you know, ASH at the end of the year in SoHo would be, you know, these newer, more selective JAK2 inhibitors that both Ajax has, as well as Incyte, and these more targeted calreticulin therapies as well. I think that's kind of, you know, new generation of therapies that are, to use the term we've been talking about a little bit, disease modification. I don't know if that's real or not with these drugs. So those are things that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. I mean, certainly, you know, again, yeah, ASCO, usually not super heme dense, but some interesting presentations this year. Hopefully with the ROPEG data, we can have a little bit more access to that within ET. I think EHA certainly there's always interesting data presented at EHA. Hopefully hear a little bit more about selinexor. Pelabresib, its ongoing development certainly has been interesting to follow, and hopefully some more data there. And then these newer kind of targeted therapies, right? Maybe a new era of how we treat these MPNs. And I think that certainly we're all anticipating whatever data we can see from those studies that are really in the early phase. But so I think to put a kind of a bow on this, you know, we certainly had the ability to kind of discuss our approach to treatment and treatment goals in specifically, right? I think despite our goal, you know, still being cures and disease modification, I think that making sure that our endpoints are clinically relevant matters, because when we're talking to patients in clinic and we're talking about what patients can do for them, if we can reference clinically relevant endpoints, I think that resonates, and it makes patients more willing to kind of consider different options. And overall, we want our treatments to help patients' lives. So, you know, hopefully in the future, we'll be able to do that with therapies that get rid of the disease, and they can not only improve patients' quality, but quantity of lives. But I think that with your work, we're also showing, you know, how can we think about this from a more kind of 30,000 foot view, right? How can we think about the patient as a three-dimensional patient and not just focus specifically on certain aspects of disease? So I thank you for joining me in our pilot podcast for MPNs. This was Gabby Hobbs from Mass Gen. I'm Andrew Kirkendall here with SoHo Insider. And thank you guys for joining us for this session of the podcast. Thanks.